What's up, Outlander fans? Welcome to Bannocks, Bonnets, and Kilts. I am your host, Jenny Coco Cure. This is episode 8 of Bannocks, Bonnets, and Kilts. We are only 2 episodes away from 10 whole episodes, guys. That's exciting. And this week we're going to be recapping Creme de Menthe, the 7th episode of season 3 of Outlander. Now, this episode of Outlander was written by Karen Campbell and directed by Norma Bailey. The air date is October 29th, 2017. Unlike last week, this is going to be a normal episode. No extra time on this one, just the full hour, or 50 minutes to be exact. Before I get into the recap of this episode, I would like to address some things about my previous episode, the recapping of A. Malcolm. First, I'd like to say that I was really pleased that a lot of people tuned into that one more than any of my other previous shows. That's a blessing. That's great. Enjoyed that aspect of it. However, a lot of people decided they didn't want to listen to the whole episode because you have like an abandonment rate. You guys know who do podcasts, what that is. Are people listening to the whole episode or are they dipping out before the end? And I had a pretty high abandonment rate on my last episode. And I would like to think that that is because it was kind of long, or, you know, maybe people just were like, I don't know. I'm thinking that it has something to do with the fact that I was fairly critical of the episode. And I would like to say that after a few more viewings of that episode, and of course of seeing how other people viewed it and listening to other opinions, going on social media, seeing how they reacted. By the way, man, I feel so weird about how some people reacted so bad. I mean, so poorly to this episode. There was a lot of criticism. There was a lot of support, of course, love. I think there were more people who loved it than didn't love it. But the ones who didn't love it, some of them really wanted people to know. And I just remember when Sam and Kat did their, I think it was some sort of Twitter Q&A. There were some nasty people saying some not so nice things. And I'm like, what is it really that serious, guys? I mean, do y'all really have to do that? You know, tear somebody down because you don't like something that they did? I was really shocked by that and disappointed. And, you know, I was thinking I wanted to take a part, but when I saw that some people were really going in, and for the most part, let me just say that everybody was respectful, but there were a few randoms in there that were just ugly. And I was like, ugh, you know, I didn't like that. But I think for the most part, though, people who were critical were at least constructively so, I guess, at least not trying to be ugly about it. But at one point it seemed like a bit of, what's the word? It seemed like a bit of, I'm trying to think of the word. I hate it when I can't think of the words that I'm trying to say. When someone just kind of pours on the criticism, it's just too much. It seemed a bit overwhelming. And because I remember this one point where this one person, I'm not going to mention names, I don't remember her name anyway, but she was, you know, really making some points that I kind of agreed with, but it was just pouring on. It was just so much. And it was all coming at Sam. And I think they were coming at Sam because he had said something about making a decision to change his reaction to the Brianna pictures. They had written in the script, there was a releasing of the script saying that they did say that Jamie should fall apart when seeing the photos. But Sam decided, nah, that's overkill. I'm not going to fall apart. I'm going to make a creative decision to change the way that I play this. And, you know, they kept it. And that's what happened. Do I still find that that was the wrong decision? Yep, I do. I still feel that way. Because there's all kinds of ways to fall apart. You don't have to fall out on the floor kicking and screaming. You know, you don't have to have a tantrum like a 2-year-old. It's not necessarily that. It's tears. Minimum. Tears. Maybe a little shuddering of the shoulders. A little tremble. You know, losing your composure, you know, for just a bit, because it's your child that you haven't ever seen in your life and you've been dreaming about for 20 years. But, you know, who am I to judge that? I only have 3 kids that if that ever happened with me and any of my kids, I would probably, you know, fall apart. But anyway, I don't know. That's just me, though. I'm thinking maybe a person who's not a parent can't relate to that kind of emotion. I don't know. You know, oh God, let me stop. I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyway, I didn't want to take in on the piling on. That's what I was trying to say earlier. Piling on. It seemed like they were piling on, with Sam on Twitter, and it was a lot of people taking part, even though there were a lot of fans going, Sam, don't listen to them. You were great. Sam, don't listen. This was perfect. The way you did it was great. It was better than the book. It was whatever, whatever. You know, so he had a lot of that too. But there were a lot of people that were going, no, you shouldn't have did that. Why would you change? It was perfect the way it was. So while I agree with that latter assessment, I just didn't feel like taking part in that piling on session. You know, Sam's a good dude, and I love him as an actor for the most part, especially as Jamie, and I'm just not gonna pile on like that. Enjoy the show, shit, you know. But as far as my show from last week, I pretty much still feel the same way about everything that I said, but for a couple of things. I have decided, after rewatching and after talking to a friend of mine who is now watching the show as well, and also listening to my show, hey, to friend, I'm not going to give out any information on you. I know you wouldn't like that. But this person listened to my show and watched Outlander, and they gave me a couple of things to think about when it came to a couple of my criticisms. One of the criticisms was of the kiss in the print shop. I was kind of, you know, like, that kiss didn't do anything for me. The first kiss, the very first kiss, when he asked permission. For some reason, I expected that kiss to be passionate. But it wasn't. It was very tame. It was my description of it. And it was. My friend was like, well, look at it this way. He said, if you go in for the kiss at first and you're kind of acting like you're going in kind of aggressively and that kind of startles her, and then you back up and then you say, may I kiss you? I would very much like to kiss you. And then she gives you permission. Do you then slam your tongue down her throat? Or do you approach her slowly and kiss her gently and kiss her demurely? And I'm like, okay, you know what? That makes sense. I can't deny that. That makes sense. Because I did note in my show about that kiss that at first he's going in heavy breathing and panting, and she kind of looks startled. So then he backs up and then he tries again. I would very much like to kiss you. Is that okay? And she gives him permission. So yeah, once you get permission, you have to be cool about it. You can't be throwing your tongue down her throat. So, okay. I'll backtrack on that one. That one seemed appropriate. As far as the clutching on the floor, you know, I compared it to the book. I said the book had them clutching and crying, and he's sitting in the aisle, and you know, and they're having an emotional meltdown there on the print shop floor. But on the show, he just kind of looks at her and he's shocked and he's stunned, and he's definitely emotional, but it's not that same, you know, meltdown type thing as it was in the book. My friend was like, he's stunned. Maybe he's still feeling it's a surreal thing. He doesn't know what to think. He doesn't know why she's there. He even says later, why are you here? Are you here for me? Are you here to tell me about my daughter? You know, so his mind is probably going 1,000 miles a minute. He's like, yeah, okay, she's here. Okay, the initial shock of that is, oh God, you know, she's here. Then why is she here? You know, he's got to be wondering, and he doesn't want to put his whole heart out there right away, because what if she's just here for the day? What if she's just here and then we'll be going back? What if Frank is still alive? What if she's just here to see me for a short period of time? It's just too good to be true that she's here for the rest of my life, you know, to be my wife again, to pick up where she left off. So, you know, there's no telling what's going on in his head. So he is measured. She said, you know, and my friend was like, you kept saying that they were being measured. Well, it makes sense that they would be measured, because they don't know what to think. She doesn't know what to expect, because she doesn't know if he's got a wife, he's got kids, he's got a life. And he doesn't know if she's going back, if she's going to stay, or if this is just a visit, you know, temporarily. So it really makes more sense, without knowing any of that, that they would be more measured. And I had to give it to him. You are so on point. That makes a lot of sense. And the reaction in the book now almost seems like it was less realistic when you think about it that way. You know what I'm saying? Still though, the Brianna pitches, sorry, you can't take that one. And my friend, he didn't even try to change my mind on that one. He was like, yeah, you might have a point on that one, because you know, we got kids. I have kids, my friend has kids, and we know that feeling, you know what I mean? And no, I think any parent out there would think that if you knew you had a child out there, even if you've never met that child, and you had that child with the love of your life, and you have thought about that child every day for the last however many years, and on Jamie's case is 20 years of thinking about a child that you don't know is dead or alive. You don't know if the woman that you love is dead or alive. And now you know that not only is the woman okay and still as beautiful as ever, but she raised your child that you've been dreaming about every day for 20 years. And that child is now in these beautiful captured images that you've never seen before. It's not a painting. It's a freaking photograph. It's not an artist's interpretation of what the person looks like. It's an actual captured moment that you get to witness. How do you not fall apart at that? And your first view of it, their very first view of that beautiful baby and your beautiful wife holding that beautiful baby, and your reaction is to close your eyes and take some deep breaths. I'm sorry. No, the falling apart part was appropriate there. Okay, I'm not going to recap episode 7 again. Not going to do that. Just wanted to give a little more explanation about some things. But yeah, I've changed my mind about some of it. So yeah, there's that. Also, I wanted to say about episode 7, I got some stuff wrong and I want to correct. The stuff that I was saying about the man in the back of the tavern. And I am forgetting his name again. I had his name. And now I'm forgetting it again. Jesus Christ. Anyway. Can't believe I'm forgetting the man's name again. The man that was waiting on Jamie to get the bribe money. I called it taxes. No, it is not taxes. He was being bribed. Well, he was bribing someone. So he was being extorted. Okay. He was being extorted by a government official. Now, I knew this from the book, but for some reason, I just didn't think to make that connection in the show. I don't know where my brain was, but yes, the man in the back of the tavern was not a tax man collecting taxes. He was a government official, someone who, you know, kind of overlooks or oversees the selling of alcohol and things like that. And Jamie, being a smuggler, this man was not worried about Jamie selling no pamphlets. He was extorting Jamie because Jamie was not supposed to be selling alcohol. He was smuggling it and selling it illegally. And this gentleman was being paid a large portion of the profits in order to allow Jamie to continue to sell his illegal alcohol. So that's what that was about. And when the man said that he heard that Jamie was selling in other areas, basically Jamie was supposed to only be selling in Inverness or in Edinburgh. And the man found that Jamie started selling in other places. And Jamie was like, No, I'm not. And that's what you're getting right there, what we agreed on. And the man was like, we'll see about that. So yeah, wanted to make that correction. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Also, I kind of overlooked the whole importance of Willie and Jamie talking about Willie right after looking at the pictures of Brianna. And I didn't make the comparison that this is, of course, different from what happens in the book. In the book, Claire does not find out right away. Well, actually, Claire does not find out from Jamie at all. Well, he does eventually confess, but it's not until much later. The way that Claire finds out in the book is through someone else. And that was supposed to be kind of a plot device. The way that she finds out about Willie. And it was kind of a big thing. So I guess they're going a different route with how they're going to handle Claire and this other person who did tell her about the child, Willie. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how the show handles it. And lastly, my last comments about my reaction to episode 7 or 6. I know that in previous shows, I said that you have to separate the book from the show. The show is a different entity. The book is a different entity. Show Outlander is not the same as book Outlander, and fans should recognize that, acknowledge it, and accept it. And I didn't do that last week. But I just think that there are some things that are so big that to change them would just not make sense. Especially if you're telling the story that the book is essentially supposed to. If you're basing a show on a book, there are just some things that don't make sense to change. Some things make sense. Some things make it better, like the whole Willoughby thing. But there are other things that are so huge to the story that to change it or remove it changes the story or changes the character, and not necessarily for the better, maybe for the worse. So I think there are always exceptions. Yes, you can change certain things and it still be the same story, but just make it more palatable for television. But you don't want to change it to the point where it becomes, where the character becomes too different or the story becomes too different. So when I talk about the whole Brianna thing, it just doesn't ring true to the character of Jamie Fraser. I just don't see him not reacting strongly to the pictures of his daughter, because that has nothing to do with Claire staying or going. It's, you know, which would make, which, you know, makes sense in the whole, you know, scheme about how he reacts to Claire. You know what I'm saying? Does he wear his heart on his sleeve with Claire, or does he, you know, pull back because he doesn't know where they stand? But with his daughter, you know, that's, oh, you know, that's where you don't have to be measured. That's where you don't have to hold back. This is your baby. This is your child that you didn't know was dead or alive. And now you see these beautiful images of her, and she's gorgeous, and she looks like you, and she's healthy, happy, and safe. And yeah, fall apart. Fall apart. That's perfectly acceptable and understandable and expected, because you love your child. You don't have to have ever met her. I heard so many people saying, well, it doesn't make sense because he's never met her. That's his child. He's dreamed about her for 20 years. He's wondered about her for 20 years. What was his favorite prayer? Please let, you know, with Claire, please her, let her be safe, her and the child, something along those lines. That was his favorite prayer. I think he probably said that prayer every night for 20 years. And you're telling me now he sees these beautiful pictures, pictures that he, you know, can't quite comprehend, that he's looking at a actual capture of a moment instead of a painting. He's looking at an image that's an actual capture of a real life moment. And that won't bring emotion. Come on, y'all. Stop making excuses. Stop. Okay. Maybe, okay, let me backtrack, because maybe those people really genuinely feel that way. I just couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree less, rather. I couldn't agree less about that. I don't think that that makes sense at all. It doesn't make sense to be, you know, not emotional or not overly emotional when it comes to that sort of thing. It makes zero sense. So anyway, let me move on. I've probably lost about 75% of you. Hopefully you'll just fast forward through my rant and continue listening to the recap of this week's episode. Anyway, let's get started with the recap of Crème de Menthe, which is why we are here, right? All right, we start the episode with a title card that I had to look at a couple of times to figure out what this was. But apparently it is an 18th century water pump or water hose or fire extinguisher, whatever you want to call it. Basically, we see some buckets and some men grabbing buckets, pouring water into this container or box-like device. And once they pour the water and the buckets into the box-like device, there's like some levers with two men on one side and two men on the other, and they're pumping on each side to get, I guess, the pressure to build up for the water. And then it sprays out of this kind of a spigot. So it looks like something that is used to fight fires. So that essentially was a title card. Some guys pouring some water into a water pump and then pumping it until it sprays out of a spigot. So that was the title card. Then we move into the first scene where Claire is in the brothel room with the strange man, where we left off last week, who attacked her, and he pushes her on the bed. She's screaming. He's getting ready to attack her. She takes a knife out and swings at him, and he's like, what are you going to do with that? You know, and she's swinging at him, and he tries to pull her down to the edge so he can, you know, do what he planned to do. But then she manages to get a good cut you know, on him. She swings and she catches him. And, you know, that pisses him off. He says, you know what, I was going to bed you, but now I'm just going to kill you. You know, so she manages to get up off the bed, by the way. And she's still swinging at him. He's coming after her. And she swings, and he's, you know, trying to avoid the knife. And at one point, he kind of jerks back from one of her swings and trips over something and falls and smashes his head on the little fireplace platform, whatever you call that area in front of the fireplace, so that it doesn't burn your house down. So he smashes his head on that and knocks himself out. And right then, Jamie comes in, Sassenach, and then he sees this scene. He's like, what's going on? And she's like, this man was in the room when I came in, and he was going through your things. Jamie's looking at her and looking at the man on the floor and looking at the knife that has blood on it, because she managed to get him a couple of times. And, you know, he's thinking that she killed him, I guess. So when Claire hears the man groan, she's like, he's breathing. She rushes down to check him, and she turns his head and can see that he's, I guess, it looks like he's bleeding from the ear. And she says it's an epidural hematoma. I have to relieve the pressure. Jamie's like, what are you talking about? What are you thinking? And she's like, I can't let him suffer. I'm a doctor. And Jamie's looking at her like, what? And then there's a knock at the door. Jamie goes over to the door and asks who it is. And it's Fergus. He says, it's me, my lord, and Madame Jen. Someone said that there was a ruckus, and we wanted to see what was going on. So Jamie lets them in. And when Fergus and the madam see this man on the floor, Jamie says she was defending herself. And madam asks who he is, and Claire says, I don't know, but we need to get him on the bed. And Jamie's like, no, Sassenach, let God take him. So Claire's like, I have to save him. I have to try to save him. Do you understand, Jamie? And he's looking like he does not. And she says, please. And then he just sighs and he helps get this guy onto the bed. So as they're getting him on the bed, Jamie asks Claire, so you said he was looking for something. And Claire says, yes, he was looking for your ledgers. So Jamie searches his pockets and pulls out a piece of paper and finds his name and comes to the conclusion that he is an exciseman. And Fergus is like, oh, Lord, my Lord, this is not good. So Jamie's like, no, it's not good, because that would mean that Sir Percival apparently thinks I'm not keeping to our agreement, because tried to extort money from me yesterday. It would be yesterday, right? Yeah. He tried to extort money from me. And because I'm only supposed to be selling in Edinburgh, but my business pursuits have expanded and I haven't, you know, informed him of this so that he could alter the price of his extortion. So, he apparently sent this man to find something out, and maybe to find my other cast that I'm selling. And Claire was like, so he's a crooked official of the crown. Jamie's like, yep. And the madam was like, okay, as far as these other casts are concerned, they're in my basement. So it's a problem. If this man is working for Sir Percival and he starts looking for him, well, Jamie says Sir Percival would start looking for this man if he doesn't show up. And she's like, yeah, that's a problem, because these cats are looking for her in my basement. Jamie's like, not for long, we're gonna get those out of there. So Madam John says, let me get one of my girls, one of the more discreet ones, to come in here and straighten things out. And Claire is like, we'll also ask her to bring some hot water and a basin and a trephine, and tell her to go to the barber surgeon, he would have one. Jamie's like, what's that? And the madam is like, what do you need all this for? And Claire says, that's a drill. and I would have to drill a hole in this man's skull. So they're looking at each other like, what the? But, you know, Claire's a surgeon. She's got this on lock. So the madam goes off, you know, to get this taken care of. Jamie tells Fergus to go do something, and Fergus leaves too. And then Claire says, I have to go to the apothecary to get some laudanum and some other things. And Jamie's like, look, this man does not deserve your mercy. And Claire is like, look, I'm going to do this, so you might as well not fight me. So she starts to get ready, and Jamie's like, look, you must not understand, because I know it's been a minute since you've been here, but the laws work differently in this time. You are in a brothel room with a man other than your husband. Law enforcement or the red coats or whoever would look at this and, think you, they would arrest you for hurting this man. And Claire's like, I'm not a whore. He said, it doesn't matter. They would look at you as being the one at fault and you would be arrested. And instead of her listening to this very sage advice, she turns her back and goes, okay, well, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And Jamie's like, stubborn as ever. All right, fine. We'll have it your way. So we switch to the basement or the cellar, where the men, Jamie and the other men, are moving the casks out, the casks of liquor out. And Mr. Willoughby, which I love, says, I admire a woman who values the sanctity of life. You know, and I'm like, I love that he's not speaking in that cartoony broken English from the book. God, this is one of the great changes. I love that. I love it. Mr. Willoughby is an intelligent man. He is not a cartoon. I appreciate that. Anyway. So Jamie's like, well, if you feel it that way, then you can go up there and watch over him. So Mr. Willoughby goes to do that. And, you know, the men are discussing why, you know, Claire, you know, should have killed the exciseman or whatever. And Fergus says something about her being a unique woman. She's just, you know, this unique woman. So anyway, Jamie's like, what's his name? Oh my God, Ian, young Ian. Ian mentions the print shop. He says, well, the exciseman was here, then they might look at the print shop as well. The print shop has to be thought about. And Jamie's like, I don't keep any casks at the print shop, and this man does not care about what I'm printing. He's more worried about this liquor. So he's like, and the pamphlets, you know, because he does print some material that's kind of controversial that he doesn't want anyone to see, the stuff that's speaking of, you know, the laws of the crown that aren't so fair to the Scots or to anyone, really. He's like, those are well hidden, and it's best to leave them there instead of trying to move them. So, you know, they end that discussion. So as they're rolling these barrels of liquor out, Jamie essentially also says to young Ian, I trust you to sell these casks of liquor. We got to get rid of them, even if we take a loss on them. And young Ian says, I won't let you down, Uncle Jamie. He says, that's why I trust you. And I'm like, so little 16-year-old Ian is selling liquor. Okay. Well, that explains a lot. Explains why he's there, what he's doing working with his uncle. So he and Fergus go off as they roll these barrels out, I guess to go try to get rid of them. So the next scene is Claire arriving at the apothecary. There's a gentleman that is already at the counter asking some questions about some herbs or medicines that he can get. And Claire shows up and she's like, excuse me, sir, I have a really emergency situation. Do you mind if I go ahead of you? The man is like, nah, I'm here. I was here first, you know? And the man behind the counter is like, wait your turn. So she's like, but this is a matter of life and death. A man's life is at stake. The man who's at the counter is not really trying to hear. He starts talking about his sister's issue. Apparently he's got a sister that is having some problems. And Claire overhears this and looks at him and says, look, if you will let me go ahead of you, I will look at your sister for you. I'm an experienced healer. And the man is like, oh, free of charge because I'm being so generous right now. She's like, sure. He's like, okay, go ahead. So she asked the man for the things that she needs behind the counter. And he's like, hurry, this is life or death. He rushes off to get the stuff he needs. So the man at the counter asks Claire, so what's wrong with the man that you're treating? And Claire says, a severe head injury. And the man says, oh, well, what's wrong with my sister is also dealing with the head, but it's a nervous issue, not a physical one. And Claire says, well, I can definitely help her with, you know, whatever is ailing her. And the man behind the counter comes with the stuff that Claire needs, tells her that'll be 2 shillings. She pays. By the way, the gentleman who is talking about his sister is looking over her shoulder, like checking her money. I'm like, okay, that's kind of creepy. So Claire tells the gentleman, I can visit your sister later. He says, I'd be much obliged. He says he's staying at Henderson. I guess that's a hotel. And he says, just look for Archibald Campbell and Margaret Campbell. And she thanks him and then heads out. So then we switch to the next scene where Fergus and young Ian are negotiating the sale of the cask of liquor with a gentleman, I guess, who might have some sort of tavern or establishment. And the man looks at all these casks and he's like, I'll give you 50. And Fergus is like, 50? This is at least 100 pounds of fine French brandy. And this man is like, 50. I know you're trying to get rid of this. It doesn't have the crown seal on it or the, you know, so I know that you need to get rid of it. And I'm not going over 50. So Ian, by the way, young Ian is the one doing this negotiating, which I found fascinating. Young Ian is like, look, I'm not going to, you know, judge you because, you know, I like you, you know, I'm not going to get mad because you're lowballing me right now. But look, 75. And if you give me 75, I'll throw in 3 barrels of creme de menthe. And the man's like, well, I am not one to turn down free liquor. So you got yourself a deal. So he pays in and, you know, that's it. They've gotten rid of the casks of liquor. So when the man walks off, you know, Fergus congratulates Ian about getting such a good deal. And he then says, you even managed to get some of that creme de menthe, you know. Apparently, I don't know, that's not good liquor, I'm assuming, from that reaction. So Ian is proud of himself. So as they're waiting for the man to come back to help, you know, someone move all these casks, Ian looks at Fergus and is like, so do you remember Aunt Claire from before when she was here? And Fergus is like, oh yeah, I was a little boy back then, but I do remember her. And Ian's like, what was she like? And Fergus says, she was a spirited woman. And he said she was very brave and that she was fearless when she was at Culloden. And he says that she would heal men who had been cut down by swords and blown to bits by cannon fire. And he says, she saved many lives, but it's also rumored that she took a few as well. And Ian is like, well, if she took lives, then likely they deserve it. And Fergus agreed with that. In the next scene, we have Claire arriving back at the room and Jamie and Mr. Willoughby are trying to hold the excisement down because he is making noise and possibly having a seizure. And Claire's like, what are you doing? And Jamie's like, we're trying to keep him quiet. He's making too much noise. And she's like, that's a reaction from the head injury. It's normal. And she checks his eyes and says that his pupils are dilated. She says, move your hand. Jamie's like, what? She's like, move it, you know, because he was covering the man's mouth. So Jamie moves his hand and she pours something into his mouth. And this eventually makes him calm down and he drifts off into unconsciousness. And she looks at his eyes again, and his pupils are dilated, and it's like his brain is swelling more, and I have to do something to release the pressure. I have to operate now. So then there's a knock at the door, and Jamie goes to ask who it is, and it's Madame Jean. She says through the door that Sir Percival is here to see Jamie. So Jamie looks concerned. He's like, I'll be there straight away. So he has to leave to go deal with Sir Percival, and Claire and Mr. Willoughby are left behind to, I guess, perform the surgery on the excisement. Now, by the way, I'm saying Mr. Willoughby, but what I really loved is that Claire referred to him as Ying Chen Cho. And that's cool. That's cool. She's calling him by his actual name. I hope that that continues. That would be so freaking amazing that Claire would acknowledge the man's real name while everybody else is calling him Jamie's made up name. I like that. I really do. So the next scene is Jamie going downstairs to meet with Sir Percival. This is a little bit funny again, because when Jamie goes downstairs, again, this is the brothel. So all around, there are people getting the freak on. There's some people in the corner. A woman is doing her cowgirl thing. I mean, just flat out in front of everybody, riding the hell out of somebody. So when Jamie goes to meet Sir Percival, and Sir Percival has some old scraggly dude next to him, Jamie says, Mr. Percival or Sir Percival, are you here for a midday romp? Sir Percival's like, yeah. I'm here to search this establishment. And the man with him is like, well, maybe afterwards we can get us a little taste of something. And Sir Percival looked at him and was like, don't make me regret that I hired you. So he looks at Jamie. He's like, look, I'm here to search this establishment, making sure you're not doing some stuff you ain't supposed to be doing. So Jamie's like, be my guest. Go right ahead. Do what you got to do. Then we switch back to the scene with Claire and Mr. Willoughby in the bedroom. They're starting the surgery. Mr. Willoughby is kind of observing as Claire starts to perform the surgery on the excisement. She makes an incision on this bruise on his head, which is apparently where the clot is. With a scalpel. She has her surgery tools that she stole from the hospital, if you'll recall. So she uses her scalpel to open up the scalp right over the bruise. It leaks a little blood. Then she takes the drill and puts it right in the incision and starts to crank the drill and drill into the skull. Mr. Willoughby is looking at this and he's, you know, fascinated. And he's like, isn't that going to kill him? She says, no, but the brain swelling will. So Claire continues to crank until I guess she feels like she's gotten through the skull. And then she reverses and cranks until it comes out. The crank comes out and she pulls it out. And then a lot of blood begins to gush from this opening. And she says, there, I've, released the clot, I think is what she says. So the purpose was to release the pressure from the clot so that the brain would stop swelling. Don't ask me. I am not a surgeon. So she thought, okay, this is good. Okay. So we switch back to the Sir Percival and Jamie search. They're in the basement. Sir Percival and his man are looking around trying to find something. But of course, all of the cask has been removed, so nothing is there. He's looking around. He's telling his man to look. They see a wet spot on the floor, and Sir Percival says, is that brandy? So his man pats it and sniffs it and says, no, that's just water. And Madame Jean is like, well, that's why I can't store anything of value down here. We have a leak. So Sir Percival is pissed. He's like, I know you're up to something, and I'm going to be watching. You're going to search this whole place, but I know you're up to something. And Jamie smirks like, okay, do what you got to do. So, you know, they, you know, got through that. So he goes back upstairs and sees Claire and Mr. Willoughby, you know, rinsing off the surgical tools, and the assignment is laid out on the bed, very still. And Jamie says, I barely got through that excisement search, man, or Sir Percival search. This ends now. So Claire doesn't immediately respond, but then she says very quietly, well, you got your wish. He's dead. So Jamie looks down at the man and, you know, notices, yeah, he is dead. And Mr. Willoughby looks at Jamie and he's like, honorable wife tried very hard to save him. You know, she did all she could. So Jamie's like, well, I don't feel too bad for the man who tried to kill my wife. And he says for Mr. Willoughby to go get someone to remove the body. So Mr. Willoughby leaves. And Jamie notices that Claire is looking kind of down. So he says, this is for the best. You know, I hope you understand that. And Claire's like, I don't expect you to understand. I am a doctor. I've been practicing this for 14 years. And I am someone who respects life and does everything that I can to save it without judgment. And Jamie's like, well, there will be other times for you to practice your abilities here, like you did last time. There'll be other patients. And, you know, she was like, you know, if I had just had everything that I had, like at the hospital in Boston, he's like, well, you're not in Boston anymore. You know? So anyway, you know, he's just comforting her and letting her know that, you know, okay, yes, you lost this one. There will be others. You'll be all right. It'll be fine. So then Clara looks at Jamie and her face kind of falls. And she says, God, I have caused you so much trouble dropping in here out of the blue and interrupting your life and putting you in jeopardy. And Jamie's like, look, you've traveled thousands of miles, 200 years to find me. And I am so grateful that you're here. He says, since you've been gone, I've been living in the shadows. And when you walked into that print shop, it was like the sun came out again, casting out the darkness. Oh, so beautiful. So he's like, I'm grateful you're here. Don't ever think otherwise, essentially. And she's like shy and she looks down and then she goes, well, I have another patient I have to see. And she starts getting her things together. And Jamie's like, what patient? And she's like, Margaret Campbell. She said, I met her brother at the apothecary. And I promised that I would take a look at her. And Jamie's like, you don't know these people? And she's like, well, you know, it'll be all right. Don't worry. And he's like, but Sir Percival is still out there. And she's like, Sir Percival doesn't know me, and, you know, he won't know who I am. So Jamie, you know, takes her arm and says, and when you're done, you will be back, right? She smiles and says, of course. So in our next scene, we are in, I guess, the bar or whatever of the brothel. I don't know if they're in a brothel or not. They're just in a tavern. It's young Ian sitting at a table, and Fergus approaches and lifts his mug to Ian and says, Master Salesman, you did such a fabulous job. And he's, you know, sits down and he says, you are such a natural salesman, just like me, Lord. We made a handsome profit today, thanks to you. And Ian is like, you really think so? And Fergus is like, yeah. You know, so, you know, he's bragging on Ian. And this is fascinating to me because I'm like, okay, so this is what we're establishing Ian as, someone who is like, you know, a salesman for Jamie, essentially. So I found that interesting. But anyway, Fergus is gushing, you know, talking about we should open a business together. There's money to be made in this town. But Ian is distracted because he's looking at this barmaid who's really cute. You know, she's over at some other tables serving, you know, the other patrons. And Fergus notices that Ian is staring at this girl. And Fergus says, you know, I notice you staring at her every time we come here. And Ian says, she's so bonny. And Fergus is like, yeah, she's very enchanting. So he raises his hand to call her over. And Ian is like, no, what are you doing? He's like, well, tonight you're going to do more than just look at her. And young Ian is like, I've never been with a lass before. And how old were you when you first did it? And Fergus was like, I was 15. A menage a trois. Ian is like, what's that? And Fergus is like, two women and one moi. Ian was like, oh God. And Fergus was like, that was a religious experience. Fergus is a hoe. But you know what? That's cool. You know, he's a young man. You know, he's very attractive. Obviously, he knows he is too. Because I remember when he and Claire first met each other again on the street in last episode. And she said, you're such a handsome young man. And he says, yes, I know, essentially. I am. So, yeah, Fergus is a little full of himself. But that's cool. I like that. I forgot to mention another cute little moment when they were talking about selling the casks of liquor. And Ian asked Fergus, so does French brandy really increase the firmness of a cock stand? And Fergus like, well, in my experience, it's the opposite. But that's what I tell the buyers. So Ian is like, well, you had me convinced. So that was cute. But anyway, after Fergus beckons over the barmaid, well, before she manages to get to their table, and Ian confirms, or Fergus confirms that he's had sex at 15 and he did the menage a trois. Fergus gives Ian advice about what to do to woo a woman. He says, buy her a drink, offer her whatever she likes, compliment her, and then repeat. Essentially, just, you know, do whatever you can to make her feel good, treat her to whatever you can. And that's essentially Fergus's advice, which I must add. Fergus, you kind of on point with that, at least when it comes to wooing someone that you're just trying to hit it with, you know. that's pretty good advice. So when the girl finally comes over to their table, Fergus gets up and leaves, and the girl asks Ian what he would like. And Ian says, you are the bunniest lass I've ever seen. Can I buy you a drink? Whatever your heart desires. And she sits down and she says, whiskey. And Ian smiles. And I must admit, you know, in the book, they describe Ian in such an unflattering way, young Ian, saying that he's got a nice face, but he's not a great looker. He's not very handsome, similar to his father, which in the book is also supposed to be kind of homely, but has a good face, but a homely face. I can't imagine what that looks like. I've struggled with trying to imagine what that is over the years as I've read Outlander. But in the show, of course, Daddy Ian is kind of good looking. So young Ian, while he does look a little strange, when he smiles and a little dimple shows up, he's kind of cute, you know? He certainly looks older than 16, but that's the age he's playing. I don't know. Maybe he is 16. I don't know what his real age is in real life. But anyway, so when he smiles at the girl, I'm like, oh, look at him. He's so cute. Look at that little dimple winking at us. But as Ian is smiling at his cute little barmaid, we notice in the background that Sir Percival's man, the one that was searching the basement of the brothel with him, is sitting over at another table watching him. So in the next scene, we see Claire walking down the street. And then she arrives at the Campbells, where she is there to see Margaret Campbell to see if she can assist her medically. When she gets there, Archibald, the brother, takes her in to see Margaret. Margaret is sitting at a table with her head down, and Claire goes to approach her. Archibald tries to get Margaret to acknowledge Claire. And Margaret says, can you tell him to come back, Archie? And Archibald is like, this isn't a client. This is a healer. And Claire, you know, tries to take Margaret's hand as she sits down at the table with her. And then Margaret starts to rant and rave, rambling. She's saying something in a different language. Something about the moon, and do you see something in the trees? I don't know. She's basically not making any sense. And then she, after she's rambling, she kind of goes into this trance, like a catatonic state. And Claire's like, what are you giving her? And because she can tell the woman looks a little druggy. And Archibald says a few drops of laudanum. And Claire's like, well, you shouldn't give her laudanum every day. Is too potent for that. And he's like, did you understand what she said? And Claire's like, no. And Archibald's like, I can interpret it for you for a small fee. And Claire looks at him like, okay. She snaps her fingers in front of Margaret's face. She doesn't respond. And Claire's like, are you guys fortune tellers? And Archibald says, yes, Margaret is a seer, but without me to interpret her visions, it's just raving gibberish. So it pretty much becomes clear that this man is taking advantage of his sister's mental illness to make money. He pretends he knows that she's talking nonsense. But she rambles. He pretends he's the only person that knows how to interpret it. He probably makes up some shit to whoever is paying this woman money to ramble to them. And then he makes money from it. So he's taking advantage of his sister's mental illness. So Claire, writes him, like sort of like a prescription. She says, just give her a tea with a few drops of some sort of oil in it whenever she gets agitated, and for her to sleep at night, give her some tea with this other type of herb or whatever in it. And he's like, well, don't you think she needs more than simple teas for me to subdue her? Claire looks at him like, why do you want to subdue her? He's like, well, when she has her wits about her, she walks around telling people stuff about themselves, and she touches them, and it gives people, you know, a little bit of a fright. And it puts me in an awkward position because I can't charge them if she's telling them stuff for free. So Claire looks at him like, okay, look, I would like to see her again tomorrow if you don't mind. And he's like, no, we're going to be going to the West Indies. And she says, the West Indies, that's a rather arduous trip for someone like her. He's like, that's why I need the tonics. To keep her under control. You know, he said sailors are a superstitious lot. I can't have them throwing her overboard when we have a rich client that we need to minister to once we get to the West Indies. So he's completely unconcerned about his sister being thrown overboard because it's his sister. He's more concerned about the fact that they have things to do and he can't end up losing her because, you know, he's got things to do. So Claire's like, okay, when you get to the West Indies, make sure she has lots of fruit and don't give this child any more laudanum, please. He's like, okay, no more laudanum. She says, safe travels to you. And she gets the hell out of there because, yeah, sleazy. So in the next scene, it is night time now. And we're back at the print shop. And Ian is down in the print shop. playing around with his new boo thing. The barmaid, he's singing to her and they're laughing and having a good time. And they end up eventually in the back with Jamie's little cot, or I guess it's Ian's because, well, who knows? Anyway, they're back there with Jamie's little, you know, bed, and eventually make it over to the bed. And Ian tries to pull up her skirt to hit it from the back. And she's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Isn't this how it's done?" And she looks at him, "I thought you worked at the, well, she said Kittle Hoosie, I think, but it's the brothel that she's referring to. He's like, "Well, yeah, I've seen the whores do it like this." And she's like, "Well, I'm not a whore." He says, "No, you're the most beautiful lass or whatever I've ever seen." And he's like, and she takes his hands and puts them on her breasts. He gets all excited. He says, "I'll do whatever you want. Just tell me how you want it." And she's like, "Lay down, I'll show you." So he lays down and she starts to go to work. So then we switch to Jamie again. He's in his bedroom at the brothel counting his little money on the table. And Claire shows up and she notices the body is gone. She asks, "So where'd you end up putting the body?" And Jamie says, "He's been stored in a cask of creme de meth where I store it in my warehouse or wherever." And Claire looks at him kind of funny and he says, "There are worse resting places, Claire." He says, "Besides, you know, it slows the decaying process." And he says that like someone with knowledge of this. And he says, "No one is likely to open that creme de menthe anyway, because no Scotsman drinks that mess." So she gives him a little okay acknowledgement look. And then she changes the subject saying, "So Jamie, don't you think it's time for us to find a place to live?" And he's like, "And leave the brothel?" She's like, "Yeah, you don't expect us to make a home here, do you?" And he's like, "Well, it's free. And I sent all my money back to Lollybrock." And she's like, "Well, maybe I could make some money as a healer. You know, I could work and maybe even open my own business." And Jamie looks like he's considering this. And then there's a knock at the door. And it's Madame Jean. Monsieur Malcolm, there's an Ian Fraser, what is his name? Is it Fraser? Ian Murray. There's an Ian Murray here to see you. So Claire's like, "Ian, you know, this is senior Ian, not young Ian." And Jamie's like, "Okay, I'll be right down." So they get ready to go downstairs. Claire's all excited to see Ian again. But Jamie looks at her and says, "Don't mention that you've seen young Ian. He's probably here looking for him." And Claire is taken aback by this. "Don't mention it. You know, this is kind of odd." So when they go downstairs to meet Ian, you know, they show Ian. He's looking quite a bit older. He's got the gray hair and all of that, but he still looks pretty much the same in the face, just a little weathered, a little aged, kind of like Jamie. And when they come downstairs and Ian sees Claire, he's like, "Claire?" And she's like, "Ian." And she goes over to him and gives him a hug. "It's so good to see you." And he looks at her like he can't believe what he's seeing. And he says, "Me and Jenny, we've mourned your death for years." And she looks almost guilty when she hears this. And she's like, "Well, I thought you were all dead, or I thought Jamie was dead, and I sailed to the Americas, to the colonies, and I've been living in Boston all this time." And it's really, you know, the look on Ian's face of disbelief, and then he has tears in his eyes, and it's really so sweet. I loved that reaction. I thought, you know, this man loved this woman. She was his sister, you know, and she was Jamie's wife. And he knew how much Jamie missed this woman. Just like in that scene earlier in the season when Jamie and he are having drinks after Fergus's hand was cut off, and Ian has said, you know, I've lost a leg and Fergus lost a hand, but you lost your heart. And he was referring to Claire. So Ian knows what Jamie has been missing. So to see her back, you know, for that to bring that emotion out of him like that and for him to cry, that touched me. That was so sweet. I love that. So then Jamie asks Ian, why was he there? And Ian says, I'm looking for young Ian. Have you seen him? Jamie says, no. Claire looks very uncomfortable and decides to keep her lips closed. And Ian is like, well, the last time he ran off, he came to see you. Are you sure he's not here? Jamie says, I haven't seen him for months since Fergus took him home, you know. And Ian is like, I'm just so worried he's been gone for weeks. And what if he gets caught up with some of these, I forgot what he said they were called, some sort of gang that has something to do with the docks. And Jamie says, likely that won't happen. They'll just send him away. Don't worry about that. You know, but if I see him, I'll be, you know, I'll send him straight home. Ian says, of course, if you do, make sure you send him straight home. Jamie says, of course. So, and then Jamie says, let me see you out. So Ian looks at Claire and says, we'll see you again soon, Claire. And Claire is like, I can't wait to see you and Jenny again. And so Ian gives her a nice squeeze to the arm and leaves with Jamie. So as Jamie is escorting Ian out, Ian looks at him and says, so she's taking your news fairly well. And Jamie says, I have not told her yet. And Ian says, okay, that's not something you want to hold on to for very long. Jamie's like, I'm waiting for the right time. And Ian says, you'll be waiting for a long time. So Jamie says, all will be well. You'll see. And Ian just gives him a look and leaves. Then we switch to back to the print shop. Young Ian is getting his rocks knocked the hell off by the barmaid. She's riding like a champ. It's hilarious because when they show a close up of young Ian's face, he is smiling. He is happier than a pig in shit. Oh my God, the smile on his face is so cute. And then as the girl is, you know, getting her ride on, she hears a noise and she stops. And Ian is like, no, don't stop. She's like, did you hear that? He's like, no. She starts riding it again. But then another noise is heard. And he goes, oh, I heard that. So then they get up and they go to see what that noise is. And they look into the front of the shop because they're in the back. So they can see through like this window. There's that man, the man that had been with Sir Percival, looking through the front of the shop. He's looking for something. So Ian says to her, look, you need to go out the back. I'll handle this. She says, you going to be all right? He says, I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. So she leaves. So Ian goes up to the front of the shop, confronts this man. What are you doing in my uncle's shop? And the man's like, you know why I'm here, boy. Where does your uncle keep the casks? And Ian says, there are no casks here. Leave. And the man's like, I know you deal with him and that smuggling. You're going to tell me where those casks are. And they get into a little scuffle. The man throws Ian off and then he falls into this wall. And the panel of the wall kind of opens up and shows the pamphlets. Oh, God. So the man reaches in there. He sees the pamphlets. Are talking about treason and the charges, you know, bestowed on people from the English crown. And the man is like, oh, okay. Well, look at what we have here. You know, betraying Sir Percival is one thing, but inciting sedition is something else. And he stuffs some of the pamphlets into his coat and Ian shouts at him to leave now. So the man aims the gun at Ian and shoots, but Ian ducks out of the way and he shoots something on the stove. There's a small fire on the stove, I guess, to, you know, I don't know if he's, there's something cooking or if it was used to keep the print shop warm. But when the shot hits the stove, it spreads the fire onto the stove or onto, and then it starts to fall to the floor. And the man comes toward Ian with the butt of the gun. Like, I guess he's going to pistol whip him. But Ian reaches for the ladle that's in this pot on the stove, probably soup or something. And he throws the hot soup in the man's face. The man screams, ah! but at this point, the fire is starting to spread really fast. And the man runs out of the front of the shop. Ian is still stuck behind this spreading fire. He's trying to stomp it out. It's not working. So he ends up going back to the back of the print shop through the, like, the glass doors. And he can see that this fire is spreading very quickly. And essentially, he is trapped. So in the next scene, we switch back to the brothel. Claire is in the room waiting on Jamie. He shows up and sees her standing by the fireplace. She cuts her eyes at him and gives him this look like, mm-hmm. And Jamie comes in and he's like, well, 20 years apart, sure couldn't erase the meaning of that look. And she says, so when did you start lying to your family? And Jamie says, well, it's not like I can tell them that the lad's been helping me with my smuggling, can I? And Claire says, well, you could have at least told him that you've seen his son. Jenny and Ian must be worried sick. They must be, you know, distraught. And Jamie's like, but he's safe. So Claire says, safe? He's risking his life working for you with your smuggling. And you're doing this without his parents' permission. And Jamie's like, he's run off several times. And it's better that he's here with me than, you know, running off somewhere and being around strangers. And Claire's not trying to hear all this. She's like, you should have told him. You should have told Ian. And Jamie's very arrogantly says, they don't know what's best for the lad. He says, I'm the one showing them the ways of the world. And Claire says, this isn't about the ways of the world. Jenny and Ian want to know where their child is. And you just lied to them. And Jamie's like, uh-huh, I sure did. Just like you and me lied through Paris. And just like we just lied to Ian about where you've been for the last 20 years. Does that not ring a bell? And Claire says, that's different. A white lie to explain to Ian about something that he can't possibly understand. And Jamie's like, oh, I didn't realize lies had shades. You know what? I just have to say this. I love new Jamie. This Jamie is not the same Jamie from before. Jamie from before was this honorable person who never lied, who did everything he could to be like this honorable, upstanding person, regardless of the fact that he always had to hide and keep himself away from, you know, the Redcoats and Black Jack and all these crazy people that were after him all the time. He still lived his life relatively naively and truthfully. But this Jamie right here is like, man, what you talking about? People lie. That's just the way of the world. You just got to lie. You got to do what you got to do to survive. Okay. And if it means I got to lie, then oh, well, you know, it's for the best. I like it. And then, ooh, Claire puts her foot in it. She says, you don't know what it's like to be a worried parent. You are not that boy's father, Jamie. And at this point, Jamie has his back to her and he pauses. I mean, like a long pause, because you can tell, like, oh, she said the wrong thing. Then he says, no, I'm not his father. I'm Brianna's father. I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. And then he says, I didn't get to have a say in how you and Frank brought her up, having her wearing that wretched thing you call a bikini. And he says, even whores have enough decency to not go praying, prancing about in the likes of that. And Clara's like, oh God, I had forgotten how rigid this century is. Either a woman is a hoe or a Madonna. She's like, so look, let me ask you this. If Frank and I had raised Brianna to be a criminal, to smuggle liquor and shit, would that be all right? Would that be acceptable to you? Jamie says, at least she would be safe or would not be in danger. And Claire's like, coming from the man living in a brothel? She says, I'll have you know that Frank was a good father to Brianna. And Jamie was like, oh, is that right? And was he a good husband to you? And Claire's like, well, what's that supposed to mean? And Jamie's like, well, you asked me if I had fallen in love with anybody else while you were gone. Well, I'm asking you, did you fall in love with Frank again? And Claire says, no, I cared for Frank very much. And I did love him, but that was before you. So then there's a knock at the door and it's Madame Jean, Mr. Malcolm, and she just barges in. She says, there's a fire in Carfax Close. And Jamie's like, a fire? Oh my God, the print shop. So, you know, he rushes out with Claire rushing behind him. So when they arrive at the scene, they see that the print shop has a fire and they're staring up at it. And Jamie's standing there and he has this thought like, Ian. And then he grabs a blanket that, or a scarf or whatever that Claire is holding and runs into toward the shop. And Claire calls after him and he goes, Ian sleeps in the back. So he's running up the stairs and he gets up there and he wraps this this scarf, blanket, whatever thing around him. So Jamie rushes into the shop. He has the blanket wrapped around him to protect him from the fire and smoke. He makes his way to the landing, you know, the second level landing that looks down at the lower level where the printing press is. And he sees Ian back there. So he jumps off the landing onto the lower level, which is kind of cool when he does that. And he goes over to Ian, and Ian, you know, he notices that Ian is, well, at first Ian looked passed out, but then Jamie touches his face and he kind of wakes up a little bit. So he knows he's at least alive. So, Jamie looks up at the upper level and, you know, notices that in order for them to get back up there, they're going to have a way to climb up. So he pushes the printing press over to that area so that he can take Ian and step up onto it. But before he does that, he does go back to the back to save the painting, small painting of Willie. So he takes that with him and he gets Ian, picks him up over his shoulder, gets up on that printing press to get up to that second landing. And that's how they get out of the shop. Meanwhile, Claire is outside looking up worriedly at the shop. We see then the pump that the men are using outside to put water into. And then they start pumping it with the levers and then the hose begins to spray water, and they're trying to battle the fire, but that fire is spreading like hell. Fergus and Mr. Willoughby also show up, and Fergus asks Claire, where's my lord? And Flair explains that he had gone inside to get Ian. So Claire and Mr. Willoughby, Fergus, are all staring up at the stairs as the print shop just goes up higher and higher in flames. I mean, the flames are just eating it up. And Claire is looking so distraught. And finally, they see Jamie emerge from the doorway and he's got Fergus thrown over his shoulder. And Claire is trying to rush to them, but they're being held back by people who are trying to keep the people back from the fire. And the local men, I guess, are trying feverishly to put the fire out with the water hose, but that print shop is gone. Anyway, Jamin makes it down the stairs, and, you know, Fergus and all of them surround him, and they bring young Ian over to the side. Did I say he had Fergus over his shoulder or young Ian? I don't recall. Anyway, of course it was young Ian, not Fergus, if I did say Fergus. But yeah, they put young Ian, Jesus Christ, on the ground, and you know, they're trying to catch their breath, and young Ian begins to explain that the man who worked with Sir Percival was in the shop, and that he had started fighting with the man, and the man threw him into the wall, and the panel opened and showed the pamphlets, and the man was able to grab some. And Ian was, you know, coughing, saying, "I'm so sorry, Uncle Jamie. I tried to stop him." Jamie was like, "It's okay. It's not your fault." But Fergus makes the very real comment that if this man works for Sir Percival and gets that pamphlet to Sir Percival, sedition, which is what that pamphlet was inciting, would be a high treasonous crime, a capital offense, and that could be some serious punishment by death for Jamie. So Jamie says, he'll leave, and at first, I think he suggests going somewhere else, but Clara's like, "We need to go home with young Ian back to Lallybroch and take him back to his parents." And Jamie agrees and says, "Yeah, well, that's a good idea too." So he says, because Sir Percival only knows him as Alexander Malcolm, does not know him as James Fraser, so he should be safe at Lallybroch. So Jamie pulls Fergus and Mr. Willoughby off to the side and gives some money to Mr. Willoughby and says, "These are the profits from the sales of the casks. Give Leslie and somebody, I don't know who he's referring to, but whoever, her share. And also make sure that you stay out of sight. Your head is on the chopping block as much as mine." So Mr. Willoughby leaves. So then Jamie gives Fergus some money and tells him that he needs to try to find the exciseman, the man working with Sir Percival, and try to stop him from giving those pamphlets to Sir Percival. And Fergus says to Jamie, "There should be a better place for you to go than to Lallybroch for you to take Milady." And Jamie says, "Don't worry. He mentions some place being miles away from Brockmoor, which is where Lallybroch is." And then Fergus says, "Wait, you haven't told Milady about your other wife?" And Jamie says, "No, not yet. I will do that once we're home safe and Ian is safe as well. Don't worry, this is going to be fine." So Fergus shrugs and then he takes off. So now the cat's out of the bag. Not that it wasn't already. Everybody already knew that Jamie had another wife. The next episode is called First Wife. So of course everyone has already guessed this part. Yes, Jamie has been keeping a secret, and that is that he has someone else, another wife. And she's in the area of Lallybroch, but apparently far enough away, he hopes, where her and Clara may not run into each other. Maybe, possibly. We shall see how this plays out. Not going to say any more about that. Then Jamie sees, he turns and looks at his poor print shop going up in a huge blaze of fire. The thing is completely engulfed now. The water pump is doing absolutely nothing. Those guys are just pumping away and nothing is happening other than the shit is just going up in flames. It's really sad because Jamie's standing there and watching this, and you can see the somber, melancholy look on his face as he watches his legitimate business, this thing that made him a legitimate part of society, a regular guy, not someone committing crimes and out here, you know, living in the shadows. This was the thing that made him a normal, upstanding man. And it's gone now. And it was sad. It was sad to see his sign on the ground burning to a crisp. Just so sad. I hated that. That was a good episode, guys. I enjoyed it very much. Very, very good. I don't like to do the little star things. I know other people do that. But I guess since I did last week, I'll go ahead and do it this week, too. This episode gets a full 5 stars. I enjoyed every bit of it. There were a lot of changes from the book, but the changes that they did this time, I don't think had a detrimental effect on the story. In fact, I think it was helpful to move the story along faster, which means it was more beneficial. And those kinds of changes, that's good. In case you guys don't want to hear about book comparisons, you might want to stop here. For those of you who like to do book comparisons, I'm about to do that. Some of the changes that were evident in this episode. Let's see. First, of course, the whole scene with Ian and the girl. Yes, young Ian did lose his virginity in this episode. However, it didn't happen at all like it happens on the show. In the book, when young Ian, I think it was after the fire, if I'm not mistaken, after the fire, young Ian, they go back to the brothel and young Ian needs somewhere to sleep. So Jamie suggests that he sleep on the floor in their room. And young Ian is like, no, Jamie, you and your wife want to be alone. So Fergus was like, well, just get him a room with one of the ladies. And Jamie was like, no, he's only, well, in the book, he's only 15. So he's only 15. I'm not having him in a room with a whore. And Fergus was like, well, I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, you know, I'm trying to remember if Fergus said he had done the same or something like that. And Jamie was like, what? And because he didn't know that. But anyway, long story short, Jamie gives in and allows this. And Madame Jean recommends a young girl that she thinks would be tame enough for Fergus. I mean, for young Ian. So she has the little girl sent for, not little girl. No. She's an adult, but she's very young still. So anyway, she comes and she's kind of petite and she looks kind of shy, I guess. I think they say she's kind of shyish. So when she shows up, I think the description of her is that she's small and plump and sweet looking or something. So Fergus looks at her and his face gets all red. He's all excited. And Jamie's like, well, what am I going to tell your mother? And Fergus says, if I were you, Uncle Jamie, and his voice croaks because he's all nervous and he clears his throat. If I were you, Uncle Jamie, I would not tell her. So that was cute. So young Ian, Jesus Christ. I keep getting their names mixed up. You guys know what I'm trying to say. But anyway, young Ian goes off with the young woman to get his cherry popped. We don't get a description of it. We just know that that's what's happening. It's happening out of the scene. What else was different? The whole fire thing was definitely different. The way that it happens in the book is young Ian was in the print shop. He had followed this man, saw the man break into the print shop. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he saw the man getting ready to find the problematic stuff. And when he saw that, young Ian started the fire on purpose to chase the man out, trapping himself inadvertently in the print shop that went up in flames. Jamie and Fergus and all of them, and older Ian is still there too, when the print shop goes up in flames. And when they see that the print shop is on fire, they don't know Ian is in there until they see him at a window. And older Ian sees him and freaks out and tries to go into the building. They have to hold him back. Jamie goes in and takes chance and pulls young Ian out. And in doing so, young Ian had actually received a little bit of heat damage, for the lack of a better term. His hair was singed on one side, burned off. His eyebrows were burned off, and they said he looked like a scorched chicken. And his face was all red. So it was more than just some smoke inhalation that, like, on the show. And Claire said when she saw it, she didn't know whether to laugh or cry. He was just that funny looking, you know. So, and Jamie did manage to save his press. As a matter of fact, I think they didn't. Okay, when they first saw the fire, they didn't know that Ian was in there. So Jamie and a bunch of his men went in to save the press. That was important to Jamie in the book, to save that press. So they managed to get the press out of the print shop in the book. But they didn't know Ian was in there until they saw him in the window. And then when they saw him in the window, Jamie went back in to get him out. So, yeah, that's another thing that was different in the book. Let's see, what else? I mean, there were a few subtle differences, like the timing of when things happened, like when Ian showed up, which was much earlier, the older Ian, and he didn't go home right away either. Like I said, he was still there when the fire started. Like I said, the changes were made to the benefit of moving the story along faster, which, was a good thing. So anyway, guys, that's it for this episode of Bannocks, Bonnets, and Kilts. I am about to get out of here. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. And next week we're going to be recapping, First Wife, which is going to be episode 8 of Outlander season 3. I can't wait for that because I know a lot of people have already guessed what this is. I've heard some people that have put some ideas out there. Some are wrong, but some were right on the money. So, as a book reader, I don't wish to give anything away, because I know there's lots of people who don't know what's coming. But hold on to your hats, guys. The ride is still riding, and it's going to get even bumpier. So, like I said, hold on. All right. Take care, you guys. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.